Right. Good afternoon, everybody. It's so nice to see a good crowd of you here, and looking forward to having a bit of a chat and a to and fro at the end of this presentation. But first of all, I'm just going to give you a little introduction into the former Rose Garden project, just to set the context before you get to the real act here from Sue Spielberg, who of course is our garden designer for the new memorial garden. Right, and thank you to Janet for producing a lovely slideshow here. We've switched from those gorgeous flowers to a plan, and we just thought it was quite important, especially for those of you who are not so familiar with Christchurch, not knowing quite who is here or not, just to show where the Rose Garden or the former Rose Garden was and the phases that we hope to undertake in terms of restoring the Memorial Garden. I'm sure you can get your bearings and you can see phase one of the Rose Garden on the right-hand side of the picture just behind the east window here, so a very prominent, important and sacred part of this site. The Rose Garden has extended into two other areas over the years, so you can really look at it as three plots. Now, I'm sure that a lot of people have thought over the years, the garden's starting to look a little bit untidy, no doubt in its pomp when it was first laid out as a rose garden with more roses being added. It was super and lovely, but over the years it did become rather untidy and unkempt despite the very best efforts of many volunteers. And I think this second photograph shows that only too well. And I should add that there really has been a concerted effort over the years by groups of volunteers. I remember being involved myself quite a few years ago in weeding the walled garden and pruning some of the roses where they'd died back. But it sort of became a bit of a thankless task. One of the problems with the rose garden, I suppose, was it was becoming difficult to move between the plants and the plaques. And weeds were easy to grow. It was difficult to weed, and things don't grow so easily under rose bushes. So one could say, well, it looks like a bit of a wild garden here, but in fact it was really just an unkempt garden despite everyone's best efforts. Can you have the next slide, please? Lovely. So, things were about to change not that long ago, and I really think we have to pay a huge amount of credit to Ian Handy, who's sitting in the back of the church at the moment. Thank you, Ian. And it's been Ian's inspiration and real drive that has led to the restoration of the garden. It's so easy for all of us to look at it and think, oh yes, something does need to be done. And it could often be on the too difficult pile, not just because it's a big task or a potentially expensive task, but also it's a very, very sensitive task. And you'll be hearing more about that later from Caroline. You don't make changes to this sort of thing lightly. And it does take an enormous amount of thought and preparation and consultation with people because it's so important to bring people with you. And I'm sure many of us know, either through personal experience or experience of friends and family, that these places of rest for people's ashes are incredibly important to people, often years and years after those ashes have first been buried. So the idea of changing or moving things However untidy the place had become, can still feel quite hurtful and quite raw for people, and that's totally understandable, which is why a huge effort has been made in this project to communicate what's happening, to talk to people about it, to get their views and their feelings, and to provide reassurance that this is going to be done very, very sensitively, and that the garden that's reinstated is going to be a place of beauty and tranquility, and will be a beautiful face to visit in the future. And I think, Ian, that was very, very much in your mind right from the beginning, about wanting especially to create a place of beauty and respect and tranquility for those who rest here and for their families. And of course, it's just very fortunate that Ian had all the sort of talents, know-how and connections to get this project off the ground. And I think we're going to see a few slides later about the actual construction of the project. But that's probably enough from me by way of introduction, because I think I'd like to introduce Sue here to give us a little presentation about the planting plans and the inspiration behind those for the garden. I think probably the only query that Ian had on this project was about garden design, and I think some of us felt it was immensely important to bring in a professional. We all love flowers, we can all plant flowers, I'm sure, and we do in our own gardens, but actually to create a public garden, and in a way this is a mini public garden, bringing in someone with the real professional skills and insight is so well worth doing. There are other processes, of course, that had to be gone through, and one of those, which can delay things frustratingly but is incredibly important, is getting a faculty, rather like planning permission, from the church authorities to be able to make any changes. And that's something that the church had to go through before works could be undertaken. But of course that faculty was given, and it was recognised that work was going to be done in an incredibly sensitive way that didn't in fact actually touch or impinge on the ashes themselves. But perhaps you'll hear a little bit more about that later. But right now I'd very much like to introduce Sue to you all. I've known Sue for some years, and having put my thinking cap on, in respect of, who could we get to come along and give us some really good advice? Someone who has that expertise and knowledge and a light touch. And Sue seemed the perfect person to go to, and I'm very, very glad, Sue, that you said yes and came all the way over from Cirencester Way to give your advice. So thank you, Sue. You're going to tell us a little bit about how you've created the garden. So thank you very much indeed. Okay. Yes. Janet did ask me to say this, and I've forgotten it already, so my apologies, Janet. We are now doing something technical. We're changing from one website to one computer to another, so bear with us. While that takes place, and in fact it's already taken place, so that's wonderful, thank you. Over to you, Sue.
Thank you, Sarah. Well, thank you for inviting me here today. My name is Sue, Sue Spielberg, and I am a garden designer, and I've been practicing for about 20 years. I was asked to say a little bit about myself, my background, I suppose. So, by way of that, I'll just say that I never trained in landscape architecture, so I'm not a landscape architect. However, my background is in horticulture. I studied at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew, about 30 years ago, And prior to that, I was a gardener at Barnsley House near Cirencester for a couple of years for a lady called Rosemary Veery, who some of you may or may not have heard about. So I went to Kew and got a Kew diploma after 3 years. One of the special things about Kew is that not only do you work in the garden in all the various departments over your 3 years there, you come back into the lecture theatre and do three blocks of study for 3 months over the 3 years. And it's a very broad-based training. So we learnt about things from plant anatomy to soil science to ecology to sports turf management. You know, so just to show you the broad range of things we learnt. But my favourite part of it was the garden design module. So I suppose I had a leaning towards that. After Kew, I went and I was taken on as technical editor for a gardening magazine based in London, which was for about 2 years until the first of our three sons was born. So we moved back to Cirencester, where Richard and I, my partner, are both from, and I continued to write articles, freelance articles, for gardening magazines. And over the course of maybe 5 years or so, I did this, but I ended up writing four books in a series for the National Trust. And it really took it out of me. And having three young sons running around and trying to write, especially these books with, you know, major deadlines, my writing career sort of came to an end at that point. So I took a bit of a break, and it was really serendipity that stepped in, because when I went in the school playground, actually, at my son's primary school, I met a landscape architect who, together with his partner, had co-founded a landscape architect's practice in Cirencester called Portis and Witten. And I think, as any landscape architect would tell you, they are very good at setting out lovely drawings, and they're very good at the planning stage of things, but their knowledge of plants is really not that great, and any plants that they do learn at throughout their sort of training isn't particularly varied. So Martin realised there was a sort of a gap in their knowledge, so he asked me if I would come in sometimes and help them with planting plans and suggest the right plants, which was what I did. And so that kept me occupied I did this on a freelance basis, and I've just grown my own sort of my own clients, and it was really, I think, just having a knowledge of domestic gardens, quite a good knowledge of domestic gardens, and being able to go into wherever they happen to send me and come up with the right sort of plants. I think I've got quite a knack for it, and I've got, you know, I've certainly got a better knowledge of plants than most landscape architects, I would say. So Sarah and I got to know each other because my father-in-law is John Sales, who used to be head of gardens for the National Trust before he retired. And we really got to know each other through John, didn't we? So it was very flattering to be asked to come and see what I thought of the design that had already been started for Christchurch. So next slide, please. So this is what I found on, these were just a selection of slides I took back in January of this year, on a cold, dreary day. And I must say, I'm not au fait with church memorial gardens, but to my mind, the planting really needed pulling together, and, well, let's have the next slide, please. Let's go to design considerations. I realised that I needed to work with the existing bed structure that and the layout that Ian had already started working on, so that was fine. And I needed to choose a range of plants that would complement the landscape here, as well as harmonise with the flowers that were laid by loved ones for, you know, as a remembrance. And those could be quite a disparate range of colours, planting, what have you. And I needed to ensure that there was something of interest throughout the year for visitors, as well as, quite importantly, I think, making it low maintenance, because the previous scheme had obviously been quite labour intensive, and it was interesting. I've never seen those pictures of what it used to be like, with the, so we should say, wild flowers through, growing through it. So the low maintenance side of things was important, but I also wanted to increase biodiversity, and choosing the right plants is always helpful in attracting bees, butterflies, the wildlife enjoy it, and of course the visitors enjoy it as well, I think. So I came up with this little scheme, next slide please, which was a sketch just to show the height range. I don't know if you can see, but there is the long stretches are the rectangular beds, followed by the little circular bed, and then a long stretch of rectangular bed and a circular bed. So that's a sort of perspective of what I have had in my mind. It's quite an grand and imposing facade, the church, so I wanted something to be in scale, so that wasn't too small and insignificant, which was why the circles have, sorry, if we can bump on to two slides, please, to the Amelanchier. Thank you. So the planting in the circular beds is Amelanchier lamarckii, which is, well, one of its common names is snowy mespilus. But it has a number of advantages, really, to a designer. One of the most important being you can buy it at quite a good size without it being too expensive, because it's naturally makes a multi-stemmed shrub. So anyway, that's the practical side of things. But in addition to anything else, it's beautiful in the spring with lovely sort of spring blossom, a bit like cherry blossom, really. I think a lot of people mistake it for a cherry. It then has these lovely summer berries, which are loved by the birds. They probably take them before you notice that they've even got them. And then followed by lovely red autumn foliage. So in terms of a good all-rounder, a good doer, and it copes with all soil ranges as well. Heavy clay, dry soil, it's a good all-round egg, I think. And so I was keen to use it. It will grow bigger, but it's prunable, so that's obviously another major consideration. If things start to get out of kilter, or if you feel they're getting too big, that they are prunable, actually. So I thought that was quite an important consideration. Next slide, please, which is Zarkokoka. So when I design something, I start with the upper layer, the key structural plants first. So the trees and shrubs, obviously here there are no trees, but the Amelanchier counts as a large shrub. And then I move on to the winter structure. So that obviously, well, most of the time it will entail evergreens. I think it's important to have a good structure, otherwise everything disappears and turns to mud, which obviously isn't as pretty, as decorative as it could be. So one of my favourites, actually, is a smallish shrub called Zarkokoka confusa. I use it a lot because it's got a lot going for it, particularly in the winter when it flowers. So it flowers in the winter, beautiful scented flowers, as you can see there, followed by blackberries, which again the birds love. But again, it's prunable, it stays small, and it is good evergreen structure. So next slide, please. Now, following on from the, carrying on with evergreen structure, one of the best ways of making a low maintenance scheme is obviously to keep the soil covered most of the time. This is where vinca, this particular variety called Gertrude Jekyll, the white one, comes into its own. It flowers in the spring, but once again, if it starts to get too big for its boots and starts rampaging everywhere, it can be cut back, and it will produce, without fail, these beautiful white flowers. And I should say, while I'm talking about white flowers, that one of the things I wanted to do here was to choose a planting scheme with the right colours in mind that would complement any other bouquets of flowers that people might bring. So that's why I've gone for white flowers, blue flowers, and a certain amount of silver foliage, which kind of holds it all together. So going on to the next slide, please, is Brunnera Jack Frost. It's got lovely blue, although I think it does come in white, but I prefer the blue. Lovely blue forget-me-not flowers in the spring, and very pretty mottled silver foliage for the summer. I've used Brunnera beneath the Amelanchiers. So there's one type of planting beneath the circular beds. There's another type of planting in the rectangular beds. But drawing it all together is the vinca that we've just seen as a general ground cover over everything. Then, next slide, please. Thank you. I've chosen Allium tuberosum, also known as garlic chives, so if anybody does want to use them for culinary purposes, they can. But again, I've chosen white flowers. I love the form that it makes. I can see, actually, from visiting here today, that even when the flowers have gone over, they've got beautiful seed heads which can remain and look attractive for as long as you want them to, until they start to go over, really, in the sort of winter mush and rains. Again, I've chosen a picture just as a bit of a close-up. Again, lovely for wildlife, really. Next slide, please. It's Geranium Roseanne. Now, I think this plant is in danger of being overused by garden designers and landscape architects because it is such a good plant. It's just brilliant. One plant in a 2-litre pot, which is about that wide, about that deep, as it grows, as it reaches maturity in about 2 to 3 years, covers an area about nearly sort of a metre in spread. So it needs to be given room, but it has this fantastic ability from one plant to just produce flowers from, I would say, June right through till I've got it still flowering in my own garden. And I've noticed it actually flowering a bit here as well, even when there was a little plant that didn't grow. It's not normally difficult to establish, so I've yet to speak to Ian about why a couple didn't take, but the ones that have grown, I think, have done beautifully. Again, it's good for wildlife. It's a real cracker. The good thing about blue flowers, a bit like white flowers, they go with all colours. They look lovely on slightly gloomy days. They don't need that the sun to sort of reflect them and make them look lovely. Next slide, please. And this is the last slide I'm going to talk about for the rectangles and circles, but this is the final plant, which is called a pearly everlasting. It's Anaphylis triplinervis sommerschnii. Again, it's a lovely thing, silver foliage, beautiful late appearing straw-like flowers, goes with everything. It's a cracking plant, really. And if I can just pop on by two slides and talk about the tubs, because that was part of the planting scheme as well. In each one, the main central shrub, evergreen shrub again, is Osmanthus burkwoodii, chosen because it's beautifully scented white flowers in April. Always looks good wherever you put it. In a border, you can let it grow loosely, and you can almost grow it as a mini tree, really, by taking some of the lower stems off so that you've got a planting area underneath. Or you can grow it slightly differently, and maybe, we can talk about this, but perhaps we'll grow them differently here as maybe topiaries, sort of domes, perhaps, in the troughs where you may not want them to get so big. So that other picture that I've put in there as well just shows that you can grow them as a small little ball or a smaller ball. It will still flower, probably not quite as profusely, but it's a very easy care plant. I should say also that the troughs there, I think it's nice to get some scent in, because with them being either side of a seat, a bench, it's nice for the scent to fill the air when you're sitting enjoying the scenery. So the other plant, Hidcut lavender, I have used in the troughs for the same reason, really. We all know what lavender looks like. It doesn't really need a slide, but it's good for the wildlife. The bees absolutely adore it. Scented, lovely, lovely blue colour. Next slide, please. And I thought, because when I popped by in the summer, I thought the troth needed something, some plant over in the corners that were sort of spilled over the edges of the planter. So in our next round of planting, which is probably going to take place in a couple of weeks' time when we do the next stage, I've also got some perennial planting. That's another thing. I didn't want to keep getting temporary fillers. It's nice to use perennials that will fill in that space and not have to be replaced all the time. So this one, called Mexican fleabane, erigerone, is a good plant for that particular position. It will spill out, as it's doing here in this container, over the sides. Looks lovely. It's carrying on flowering even now. It's a good plant. The next slide, please, is, and I wondered if maybe we could also use campanula. This little campanula is another spiller that's perennial, that has flowers pretty much all summer long, and lovely foliage as well, the evergreen shiny foliage that, as I've shown there. And if we could just pop for two more slides on to the bulbs, thank you. One of the important things to get in place are bulbs, spring bulbs, so that you have an interest from right early in the season through, well, till beyond now really, into October and possibly into November. So, and the best way of doing that is with spring bulbs. So the plants I've chosen, which haven't been planted yet but are due to arrive in about a week or so, are these. Now we have for the circle beds the Narcissus Pueblo, which is scented white. It grows to about that high, so it'll come up higher than the Brunnera that's also planted there. And then for the rectangular beds, there's a little Narcissus called Elka, which is the best way I can describe it. It's like a white version of the little tete-a-tete daffodils that we all probably know and love. It's quite small, but it's just a better colour for this particular planting scheme. But from the earliest point in the season, I've gone for crocus, blue crocus, because hopefully they'll naturalise. They will be planted, I think I may have ordered enough for both the rectangles and the circular beds, but there's certainly enough for the rectangular beds. And next slide, please. For the tubs, I've gone for a very early Scilla Mischenkoena, which has got a slight scent to it, but that will probably flower at about the same time that snowdrops would be flowering. I haven't gone for snowdrops. I've avoided that because I don't know what is in the rest of the graveyard. There may well be lots of clumps of snowdrops, and I didn't want to overdo it. So I wanted to bring something different to the party, really. So this little slightly white but blue-streaked Scilla fills that particular slot, followed by Narcissus Hoera, which I know it's not white and it's not blue, but it's a sort of a creamy yellow colour. But it's a lovely, a scented, pretty little sort of scented daffodil, again, for those tubs where you're sitting in the spring. I don't know if you want me to talk about ongoing maintenance, but just really, because the maintenance issue is important, I can talk about this to Ian, but it's basically some cutting back where it's sensible to do so. It's pretty much common sense, like the vinca can be cut back if necessary, so can the Brunnera, and the anaphylis, that just gets cut back when it started to go a bit mushy. That may need digging up and replanting every maybe 2 to 3, so I put 3 to 4 years. And the geranium, basically just cutting back, and the lavender cutting back. So that's I don't really need to say a lot there. So my final slide is just to show before and after. So that's it, really. Thank you.
Sue, thank you very, very much indeed. It was wonderful to see those flowers and how they all mix together. And, of course, we can look outside and see them through the changing seasons. Now, we do have some more slides to show you, and Caroline is going to talk to those. So if I...
Questions for Sue first? Should we do questions at the end? Oh, we can do questions at the end, yes. Okay.
Okay.
Right. Is that's all right, Sue, we'll do questions to everybody
no,
at the end.
I'm going to move, actually, so I can see.
Well, this is amazing, because I didn't know all about this. Yeah. I only came in at this stage when Ian said, what are we going to do about the plaques? So I thought, well, I think I could work out what to do about the plaques, which we'll show you. Ian most carefully divided everything up into squares with string and labels. And then we took the plaques out, most carefully, and put them in trays with the labels in the undercroft, the old boiler house under the church. We did them a few at a time because they get a bit heavy. And I must remember to say a special thank you to Elsa and Mike because they helped with this stage. So thank you. And then when they put the rectangular and circular beds in, we had to take the plaques out again and give them a good wash. So that was me. And then we also had some wonderful help from Elaine, sitting in the front here, looking a bit different because she's let her hair out now. So we gave them all a very good wash and scrub, just very gently with washing up stuff and a washing up brush. And we most carefully looked after the water because, of course, it had soil in the bottom. And then we put them... before we put them back, of course, Ian put his watering system in before the steels went back, and then the steels went back, and there's the watering system, and then we put the plaques back as nearly as possible to where they had been, because, of course, some of them had come out from under where the beds are, so we just had to move them a little bit. But we tried to put them sort of up and down as near as possible. And there's the expert at putting the... Some of them were really difficult because they've got great big long spikes on, so Daniel's the expert at that sort of thing. So then I think, yes, then they all look... Hopefully they all look tidy. Some of them were broken, but we just sort of laid them on the soil and made them look as tidy as possible. And that's also the beautiful new path that Ian has arranged. And the flower holders that we provided. So, I think that's about all I wanted to say, really. But we did try and look after the plaques as carefully as possible. And there you can actually, on the end of the path, you can see that it's a sort of herringbone thing, full of stones, so that the stones don't get away and rush about everywhere and get on the beds. And then that's what it looks like now, and it's ready for Sue's next lot of planting, I think. Okay, has anybody got any questions? Because I can bring the microphone. The only other thing to say, thank you to all you friends, because we have made quite a significant financial contribution to all this work. So that's what this is for, really, to say thank you to the friends.
Thank you, Caroline. You can just see how much effort has gone into this project. Just like to echo thanks, and especially to Ian at the back, whose vision this was, and it's really happening, isn't it? And I think, Simon, you said the other day, we can't stop now. So phase one in the process of being completed, phases two and three to come. But thank you, Sue, very, very much.
Pleasure.
And has anyone got any questions, either to Sue or anything else that's been mentioned, Simon?
Thank you, Sue and Caroline. Really appreciate it. I suppose, Sue, what I slightly, say cheekily, would sort of overview. So we've tried really hard for many years to improve the whole ambience of the site. So, for example, you probably know that the community center was our rubbish tip, and it's now Garden Reflection. And it's been hugely appreciated during lockdown. People haven't got gardens coming up here. But our biggest challenge now, and with the whole of this site, and I'd love your comments, would be, we're an eco-church, and how we hold that eco-vision as a living churchyard. Mm. So we have, in the past here, won conservation awards for our conservation management, But fair to say, a lot of controversy in the community about length of grass and all that sort of side. So I wonder, you know, as you've been coming up there, do you have any overview about living churchyard and say in 3 to 5 years on what we could do to be known to be a community which inspires ecological awareness? I'll give you an example. So I don't know if you know at Coate, the Richard Jefferies Museum, but in fact, the curator there, Mike, came around with me and just got an idea. So you just across from the bottom of the burial ground is a woodland. And the idea, we might write to the parish council and say, could we take over that woodland as an eco scenario? So when you're coming up here, I appreciate this is your idea. Any views about how we could be a living churchyard and almost be known for our ecological awareness alongside of being a beautiful ambience for those who come there. Does that make sense?
Yeah. That's such a lovely desire, a lovely aim to have, and I'm absolutely 100% for that. How could you do that? Well, I haven't actually explored the outer perimeter of the church. I've only kept sort of to this area, but I think if there is an area where there is like a little mini woodland or some trees further away, there's so much that you could do there. You know, planting, there may well be them already, but things like bluebells, primroses, I would say cow parsley, but that I know, I think that might wind Ian up. Sort of, you can allow an area to go a little bit wild, and not only that, maybe even build in some habitat piles, some dry hedges where insects and reptiles can take shelter, bird boxes, bird feeders. I mean, that might be quite nice in certain areas. It's nice to be able to encourage people down there, so provide seats and maybe even plant if there's no place already, but just maybe screen off a little bit so it's a little private area where anybody visiting the churchyard to, you know, visit their ashes, their loved ones or whatever, just a quiet space so they can sit and ponder with beauty around them. This should certainly all help, because I do plant for the wildlife and for the butterflies as well as the bees. I think that's about it, really. I hope that's helpful.
Thank you. That's a wonderful start.
Anyone else? Margaret.
My question's not about this new part, but about the rest of the churchyard and the green area out the front. We used to have hundreds and hundreds of snowdrops, which looked lovely in the grass. And recent years, we haven't had so many. How long after they have bloomed should we wait until the grass is cut?
I think it's a tricky one, actually. I think probably about 6 weeks. Really, it's when the foliage has started to die down, which often doesn't correspond to when you want to start cutting the grass, because by that stage, the grass may well have grown up to about that tall. It's a difficult regime, really, a mowing regime, to fit in with that. If you wanted, the snowdrops will undoubtedly still be there.
Yes.
So if you could locate them as soon as you see them and move them as clumps and maybe use them under the areas where there will be more, the areas are allowed to turn a bit more wild so that their foliage can die down. That's what I would do, actually, and keep the smart cut areas just as smart cut grass.
Yeah, right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Just a quick question. I just wondered what happened to the floodlight, because the floodlight used to be at the back as part of the garden. So.
Stephen, would you like to answer?
Well, the floodlight you were talking about, Angela, wasn't working. Hadn't worked for about all the time I've been in the buildings committee, so in the end we took it away. It was meant, designed to light the east window, but it used to blow all the fuses all the time, so we've removed it. Did you give us money for it? It's gone, safely gone. Can I ask myself a question? the sort of elephant in the room that needs to be answered, first of all asked, is we've done we're all struggling to know what to call the former rose garden, because in 10 years' time, everybody will look at you strangely and say, what roses? But let's call it the north-south garden, that one that we are talking about, most of what Sue's designed. We also have an east-west section, which is here, which sadly is equally, or has been sadly, neglected for all sorts of really good reasons, which Ian can tell you. Concerning the ground is terrible, it's full of roots, it's full of, what are those trees, Ian? Lime trees and suckers and things. Has Janet got a picture of one? Oh, thank you. It's on the plan, phase three. It's a really difficult to manage area, and we haven't got permission to do it yet, so at the moment our current project, phase one there and two, is all authorised under faculty, but phase three remains to be resolved, and that's, I think we'll be talking to Sue, that's going to be difficult, but not impossible. But I think the idea is that we would want to bring the whole, we've talked about three garden areas, but we'd like to see it as one somehow. I don't think it suits some of the more formal stuff, because there's all these great big trees, but that's work in progress. So we're looking to make an application to do that work as soon as we know what it is we're going to make an application for. But we're aiming to do that between now and spring, really. So we'll be asking you soon, what should we do now? Importantly, I think we must just reinforce Ian's efforts. Ian is the driving force behind it. We have to kind of keep him back a little bit because he's so keen. But I think, Ian, your quote about we've got half of East Anglia's soil out here, it's amazing that there's any soil left in East Anglia, because the new soil that's been placed in the beds comes from the washings from sugar beet in East Anglia. So we've got loads of soil that all comes from East Anglia. So East Anglia is now even flatter than it was before.
Thank you. Has anyone else got anything they'd like to add or comment on or ask? No? Janet?
I just wondered if there's been any feedback from the people that visit.
I think Ian is probably the best person to ask that. Ian, would you like to say a word?
The man of the moment. We're asking about you. You're all there, always there.
Questions. I think that is the satisfaction I'm getting, is that we get such favourable feedbacks. People are walking past, they say this is just wonderful, they're pleased to see the progress we're making, and as far as I'm concerned, long may it continue, there's more to do, but we've certainly got off to a very good start, and I appreciate the support we're getting to that effect.
Anybody else? No takers.
I think that just leaves me to say, you know, thank you all very, very much for coming, and for Caroline and her team for preparing lovely homemade cakes and tea. and for Sue coming over and talking to us. So thank you all very, very much, and a particular thank you to Janet, who has managed the technology even when things got tense. It's always the technology that's tricky, so thank you, Janet. And enjoy the rest of your afternoon. Thank you. Goodbye.